Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. We're talking about plastics this hour. We just learned about a citizen science initiative that's searching for tiny plastic pellets called nurdles that are washing ashore on beaches across the Gulf of Mexico, mostly in Texas. Now we're turning to another citizen scientist who lives in Cape Coral who has spent his career in the world of plastics and packaging. Warren Schirato is a packaging development and design engineer who has spent a whole lot of time researching plastics and the never-ending efforts to use less of them or discover more environmentally friendly ways to make them. Warren, welcome to the show. Thanks for reaching out to us and getting our attention.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you letting me join in the conversation.
All right. And as always, if you would like to add your voice to our discussion, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That is 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So before we get started, I want to play a little short bite from a guest that we had on the show recently that really crystallizes just how much plastic we use in this world these days.
Basically, from 1954, when it really started becoming very, very prevalent, until 2015, we had over 448 million tons of plastic production globally. And from 2000 to 2015, over 40% of that 448 million tons was actually made. So we are really turning into a plastic-making society.
That was Dr. Terry Root. She's a senior fellow emerita at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University. She was also a lead author for the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, which was co-awarded the Nobel Peace Prize with Vice President Al Gore in 2007. We had her on the show recently because she was in Southwest Florida for a presentation on microplastics. So, Warren, would you think it's safe to say that we are maybe collectively waking up in the past few years to the realization that we've made too much plastic and it's wound up everywhere?
I don't know that I would say we make too much plastic. It's just going in the wrong places. A lot of the world economy is based totally upon making plastics. There's efforts by the Engineering for Change group to get plastics to be converted into kerosene as well as other petroleum products in Africa. So they take the plastics, break them down, convert them into usable energy. So that's one good thing. And having the plastics there and available to breaking it down is good for them, but it's not good for the atmosphere when they burn it.
Right. Yeah, that's the downside is that even if we burn it, then there's another environmental negative impact.
Exactly. But as far as overall plastics, plastics are not going to go away. They're part of our being now. Cars, dishes, food. There's polymers in food. So as far as overall goes, the plastics are with us to stay. They're not going to go away.
Tell us a little bit about your background in this world of packaging. I mean, I don't know if I've ever met a packaging design engineer before.
Well, we take all of the product that's being made by somebody who has a brilliant idea about a product that they want to get out to a customer, whether it's pharmaceuticals or medical device or food or whatever it is. We look at the materials required to move that product across either a state, continent, or the world and try to make sure that that product gets to the end user in a condition that can be utilized.
Can you talk a little bit about the scope of the kinds of plastics that you would have been using in your industry over the years?
Wow.
Is that a very broad question, assuming?
That's a very, very
broad
question. Polypropylene, polyethylene would be two of the larger polymer groups that I would say that are used more extensively than anything else. Eastman Products has a PETG product that you see go into packaging for things like salads, salad trays that you see at the marketplace to pick up salad to go. Those usually PETG plastics. They're clear. They're pretty durable. So you see that ketchup bottles, mustard bottles, milk bottles, all range in the kind of like three large polymer categories, polyethylene, polypropylene, and PET.
Are those all made from petroleum? basically, at the beginning of the day?
Methane would be one source. Petroleum would be another source. Methane breaks down a little bit faster. It's a smaller product molecule. So it gets broken down fairly quickly.
Fair to say you were familiar with nurdles before the Nurdle Patrol segment we just ran?
Correct. I know them as pellets. And the name nurdle is just kind of like annoying to me in the fact that it makes it seem cute and inoffensive. And having the pellets washing up on a shoreline for animals to consume is very, very bad. Now, some pellets are going to float. Some pellets are going to sink. It all depends upon what they're made out of. When the pellets are made, they're usually shipped out either in truckloads, truck and trailer loads, or in rail cars, large volumes in rail cars. So you take somebody like Owen Corning or Owen, Illinois, and they will receive train loads of pellets to be used. They go into the dryers. Pellets are hygroscopic. And they need to be dried before they go into the production area. And
what was that word? Hygroscopic?
Hygroscopic. Then absorb water.
Oh, okay.
They absorb water.
Oh, so they've taken some moisture out of the air or whatever, right?
Correct.
Gotcha.
So they need to be dried and then run through the processing equipment to be made into your ducky bottles for your toilet bowl cleaner or Coke bottles. Again, depending on what the plastic is.
At what point in your career, or has it been there all along, did the idea of an environmental or a need to be sustainable perspective arise in you?
It's always been there. Anything from polyethylene foam, which is used for cushioning, to Tyvek, which is a polypropylene material, spun-bound polypropylene product that's used in the medical devices world. So back in the 90s, I was part of a group that was trying to get recycled packaging used for the electronics industry. This would be from anybody from IBM to Apple to Hewlett-Packard. Whenever a piece of equipment went out, it would go in a box, a substantial box, along with the packaging material that would get returned back to the originator. The document was finished, and it was never published after that. For what reason, I don't know. But it was – I spent probably a year and a half trying to create the document, get it out and get it in use, and it never took off.
The packaging industry as a whole, I mean, are they pushing toward biodegradable and or, you know, more environmentally friendly, or are they just basically looking at the bottom line and until the bottom line balances out in the right direction, it's just not going to go that way?
Yes. All of the above. A lot of the manufacturers that are out there right now are looking at trying to really reduce. Some of them call the process sustainable, where they look at cost reductions in the packaging that is used. So the material is thinned out or maybe modified slightly to reduce their cost, and they're referring to that as sustainable. Now, if you take a look at other companies, Windex, I believe, is a product. But anyways, there's a movement within Johnson and the company that makes the cleaning solutions up in Wisconsin. I can't remember the name of them. But anyways, they've got a bottle that's being made of recycled plastics, and the plastic is actually coming from the ocean. It's being picked up, cleaned, and made into nurdles and then shipped to them to be used in bottles for their product.
Interesting. I'm talking with Warren Schirato during this part of the show. He's a packaging development and design engineer and citizen scientist who focuses on the world of plastics. To make a comment or ask a question, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You know, last year I talked with a professor from the University of Alabama in advance of his visit to FGCU for a lecture on so-called green chemistry that mostly focuses on his research into making a biopolymer using chitin found in shrimp shells. Dr. Robin D. Rogers is a research professor at University of Alabama. He's adjunct professor at McGill University in Montreal and president, owner, and founder of what's called 525 Solutions. He said his ultimate goal is to replace all plastics with biopolymer plastics made from natural materials. Let's listen back to some of that interview now because it was pretty interesting. Let's talk about plastics. That is sort of your main thing, right? Can you explain how plastics are currently made I know we don't think of them as being very natural, but really more chemical in nature. Is that a correct assessment of what plastics are and how they're made now?
It is, and I'm going to tell you a little story. Hopefully it won't be too long. The first plastic is essentially a synthetic polymer that chemists have learned to grow, make, and manipulate. Almost all of the chemicals that are used to make these plastics come from oil. So think of that, oil-based chemicals that are used to make long-lasting polymers. The first synthetic reaction to make a polymer was back in the 1800s, but the first synthetic plastic product didn't occur until 1920s, and it was called Bakelite, mm-hmm. high-end specialty dishes. In fact, in the 20s and 30s, Henry Ford was making materials out of natural polymers, like cellulose, for example. And he would advertise, he had advertisements for his cars that it, for the farmers, from the farm field to the car, or farmers will be growing your cars. And so the concepts I'm talking about are actually pretty old. But there was a problem, and that problem was World War II, and we had to make rubber because we couldn't get the natural ingredients for that. And so the government put huge resources into making synthetic rubber, and that led to all this knowledge for synthetic plastics. And today, I believe plastics is about a $654 billion industry, because if you put money at it when it's expensive at the beginning and develop product after product after product and you get large-scale users, the cost goes down. So the chemistry is excellent. We can control every property of every polymer and make every specialty plastic that you can think of, and the cost gets getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. Now, that's the good part. The bad part is, well, polymers are meant to be resistant to degradation. You want them to last, and they last. And in fact, they last so long that we're ending up with a world covered in plastic. I know you've heard the story of the plastic ocean about the size of Texas floating around in the Pacific. You've probably seen the pictures where these uninhabited beaches in the remotest place of Pacific Ocean are covered with bits of floating plastic, and it's a problem that I believe society has begun now to recognize. Even Europe is now saying they're going to be plastic free in certain areas by, I don't look like 10 or 15 years. The problem I see is I don't see doing it cold turkey without economic collapse. I think what my takeaway message is that the evidence is clear. We can't continue to do this way.
So talk about your approach. You have developed an approach to extract polymers from biomass in a very non-traditional way. Is that a correct way to put it?
It is. I actually feel like I'm going back to Henry Ford. He got stopped because all the polymer chemistry became so cheap. But if we picked up where we already knew we could go, we could extract cellulose from trees. Instead of just making paper, you could add additives to it to make it stronger. You could extract one I'm doing right now, which I'm really excited about, a polymer called chitin, which you can extract from shrimp shells. So imagine all the shells you throw away when you eat your shrimp actually contain a polymer that could make materials that might be more valuable than the food you just ate.
Now, how does that process work? Is there a simple way to explain it, or is it too deep in the chemical weeds?
You know, there should be nothing too deep in the chemical weeds. I need to find a way to explain it, so I'll test it on you. We came up with a liquid salt. It is a chemical, but it's you know, sodium chloride you put on your food as a salt, but it's highly crystalline and high melting. We came up with a liquid salt at room temperature, and it turns out that liquid salt can dissolve the chitin away from the rest of the components of the shell, which is primarily calcium carbonate and protein. So essentially, the process is pretty simple. You introduce the salt to the shrimp shell. It dissolves the chitin and pulls it out. And then to make whatever material I want to make, I simply put it in water, which washes the salt away. And it allows the polymer to be coagulated. So we've made films and fibers and beads, composites. Lately, we're even 3D printing with polymers, biopolymers.
So what is the cost of this liquid that you use? Is it an expensive liquid to produce, or what is the source of it?
Now you hit the nail on the head. So the first question I would have asked would have been, what is the toxicity and long-term environmental impact? And those, just to answer very briefly, very low toxicity that's being registered in Europe under the REACH legislation. But the key one that any business person wants to know is, what is the cost? Well, the cost is high at the moment. But I'd like to point out, and that's why I told you my story at the beginning, the cost of plastics at the beginning was incredibly high, and they could only be used in specialty products like dishware that to sell to into kitchens, you know, cooks. What we have to do is we have to get economy of scale. So if we can get enough of the chitin polymer to make enough high-value products, then the cost of making the solvent will go down. And that's just you can follow that in any chemical business. If there's if you get a large enough scale, there are enough customers, then the cost gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But any new business opportunity right now is going to suffer some in comparison because the cost is high. I mean, it's not exorbitantly high. I mean, we're doing it, but it's higher than plastic.
How has your efforts, or how have your efforts gone in terms of finding investors for this? Because it seems like, you know, you've got a proof of concept. What you're doing isn't, you know, mumbo jumbo. It's real. You've got a whole company, and you're really doing it. What is what is your impediment to moving forward with getting investors?
We have formed a joint venture called Mary Signum Limited. 525 Solutions, my company, licensed all of our patents from the University of Alabama, and we have rolled those into a joint venture. It's on the web. You can find it now, Mary Signum Limited. And they have raised investment so that we can build the first chitin extraction plant using the ionic liquid technology. And I'm hoping that the plant, well, it's being built right now. I'm hoping it's operational this year.
Where is that?
So there's nothing. It's going to be in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay.
They didn't take my suggestion to put it in Alabama, but that's okay. So the idea is that, well, first of all, chitin is a $64 billion worldwide industry, and there's not a single chitin producer in North America at all. Now, the reason for that is the only other process to get chitin from shrimp shell is very heavily chemical intensive, and you just can't get permitted for that type of a process anywhere except in Asia. So our process, we'll have a unique U.S. supply. But because of what we can do with the chitin, in addition to just extracting it, we should be able to go into very high value specialties like surgical fibers, for example, because chitin is antibacterial. So imagine that you could offset the cost of starting a brand new process by having a very high value specialty chemical. And then as you do product after product after product, the price comes down, the economy of scale grows. Then your material can enter into lower and lower cost markets. And the ultimate goal is to use blends of biopolymers, natural polymers, to replace the function of every plastic that's out there.
That's Dr. Robin Rogers. He's a research professor at University of Alabama. I caught up with him last year in advance of an event he held here on FGCU's campus about green chemistry. And so he mentioned during that interview that, you know, we're not going to go cold turkey, and that kind of swings us right back to the beginning of our conversation. But he also mentioned that the entrenched industry is not going to necessarily warmly embrace alternatives that they're not making. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is correct. There's a lot of kind of grousing going around in the plastics industries. that says basically if we're going to recycle plastics like PET, PETG, that we're going to go ahead and do it with solid PETG and none of the plastics that are being made out of biopolymers. So they're concerned about mixing and contamination of plastics and losing or having the plastic degrade as it's being recycled. So there's very much of a concern about mixing of plastics.
In the world of the packaging industry, I mean, if somebody came along like him and was able to scale up and get the cost down, there would be no reason for them not to switch over, right? I mean, if the function was the same and the cost was lower?
There is a possibility of having that plastic go into specialty marketplaces for the dedicated marketplaces like the pharmaceuticals, medical devices, food environments. The plastics that are used there have been verified and validated.
Understood.
As far as production and use goes to make sure that they're FDA approved.
Okay, FDA approval because they're
right.
Touching food or medicine.
Exactly.
Understood. So he talked about using chitin from shrimp shells. What are some other approaches to making these bioplastics or biopolymers?
There's a lot of different research that's going on out in the world right now. A couple of the processes, I'm familiar with is using yeast, a bacteria to create a polymer, and that polymer will then be used to make various different parts and pieces. And when the plastic is done from and that's been made from this biopolymer, it can be wetted or dissolved back into its basic elements and not a polluting element. So
is that the PHA?
PHA, yes.
Hmm. I've read that there are some places that are using incentives to try to get people to use to use less plastic through either. Here you talk about it. We talked a little bit off the air there. So where are some of the places that are encouraging people using governmental approaches to reduce their use?
The plastic materials that are out there right now or that have been out there are being looked at to be used less by the design engineer such as myself. The person that's responsible for the particular bottle or tray is sitting there saying, well, how can we reduce our impact on the environment? So they look at using thinner materials or blended materials that are less impactful on the environment. So there's a lot of work going on in terms of trying to maneuver packaging into a little bit more friendly of a face that to be looked at and say, okay, it's not so bad. It's not that ugly of a product that or package that we have to look at. Packaging overall has gotten a very, very bad rap. It's called a necessary evil. We're looking at the world and trying to make amends.
If you're just tuning in, we're exploring the world of plastics on today's show. Right now I'm joined by Warren Schirato. He's a packaging development and design engineer and a citizen scientist who focuses on this world of plastics. We have a few minutes left. If you'd like to add your voice to our conversation, the number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Another thing that came out of the interview that we did with Dr. Terry Root, who we heard a bite from at the beginning of this segment, was about sea salt. Let's hear another clip from her now.
Plastics in the ocean do soak up some toxins, but then when all of this breaks up, it forms such small pieces that you really can't see them. You can a little bit with your eyes, but not really. They're the size of a salt grain. And they did a study, and they found that in 100% of the sea salt tested had microplastics in it. And I had a woman in one of my talks say that she didn't believe me. And then later I got an email from her and she says, I went home and I dumped all my sea salt into a bowl and put in water, and down in the bottom of the bowl after everything had melted, all the salt had actually gone into the water, there was indeed plastics. So it's not just hurting animals, and it is hurting animals dramatically. It's also hurting us. So we really shouldn't be eating sea salt right now. You should be eating Himalayan pink salt.
Is this something you're familiar with, Warren?
Oh, yeah. There was a recent study that I just heard. It was on PBS, as a matter of fact, where they were talking about polymers and showing up around the world in places that were completely unexpected. The one place that they brought up was in the Pyrenees mountains.
Oh, said, I did see that. Yeah.
They said that.
How scary is that?
Yeah. They're 60 miles from any one place, and there was plastic in the mountains. And they said that they were totally stunned. So in the Mariana Trench, all the way to the tops of the mountains of the world, we're finding plastics.
And we've come up with this on the show a couple times when talking about microplastics, that they continue to break down into smaller and smaller pieces to the point where there's even some small pieces that are able to move across cell membranes. So it's not even something that's going in your mouth and winding up in your gut.
Right.
It's completely systemic. And then because of bioaccumulation, you know, a microorganism gets it, and then a fish eats it, then a bigger fish eats it, then we eat the fish, and then we've got all those plastics.
Right. It's a process that we're going to have to learn how to control. There's no question about it. We need to reduce the amount of pollution that's going into the world. State, federal governments, local governments, they're the companies – not companies. They're the groups that need to start looking at regulating how – materials are going to be used for the packaging environment, because the packaging, I mean, there's automotive. If you look at that, there's building construction, but packaging by far and away uses most of the plastic in the world.
Have you heard about plastic eating microorganisms that are naturally occurring? I read a story the other day that said that there's speculation that because there's so much plastic out there and sort of natural selection, that those few microorganisms that are plastic eaters might scale up in a sense to try to take care of the problem we've made. Does that resonate at all?
I've heard about that, about the research. This kind of a scary thing because if we start looking at the plastics being broken down by microorganisms, you know, what kind of impact is that going to have on our plastics that we want to keep, want to have be whole during the life cycle of that particular package? So if it's going to break down, let's break it down after what's done and being used.
So. Isn't that interesting? Are you familiar with the trash tag challenge that's been floating around the internet? Maybe you don't spend enough time on Reddit.
No,
it's a really interesting thing where people will go out and pick a beach and get a team together, and they'll pick up all the garbage, and then they'll put them in bags, and then they'll take a picture, and then do hashtag trash tag. And that way it raises awareness about, you know, the need to go out into the world and spend some time with your own hands. Real quick, let's take a call. We have just a few minutes left, but let's take a call from Merrill in Fort Myers. Welcome to the show.
I bought a BB gun to shoot squirrels, and it's a little thing, you know. I specifically bought it because it took BB pellets that were right on the top in bright red letters that said biodegradable. And it did feel like these, they were very light, but I was very suspect. Anyway, the gun broke. But I mean, can you put that on your label?
Can you imagine a biodegradable BB, I guess is the question, Warren. Sure. Merrill, thank you very much for the call. I'm going to go ahead and put you on hold so we can finish up the show, but we appreciate your input. You can listen in.
Sure, absolutely. There's some polymers made out of sugar, and they say cane sugar, for example, and you can harden it, and it will dissolve. So, yes, I can imagine
that's
that.
Theoretically possible.
Yes.
Okay. Real quick, we only have like 30 seconds left, but you sent me over a document about the Basel Convention that's coming up. Is that maybe what Dr. Rogers was referring to in terms of the European Union trying to stop all plastic use in the next 10 to 15 years?
Well, this is a global effort at trying to reduce packaging – or not packaging, but plastic pollution. It's trying to come up with some kind of a conclusion as to what to do with plastics that like – get into bales. There's waste management. They collect the plastic, they bale it, and they put it in an inventory in a warehouse and get it ready to be going out to a buyer, such as what China used to do, but it's no longer doing that. So they're collecting the plastics, and they're trying to figure out what to do with the plastic that's being collected.
Because real quick, China used to take our plastic. Now they won't, right?
Right.
Because that's a rock and a hard place for a lot of people.
Right. It's contamination.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for the show. I want to thank my guest, Warren Schirotto, who is a packaging development and design engineer and citizen scientist. He lives in Cape Coral. Warren, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks to my earlier guests, Jace Tunnell from the Mission Aransas National Estuarine Research Reserve in Port Aransas, Texas, and Maya Burke from the Tampa Bay Estuary Program during our segment about the so-called Nurdle Patrol. If you missed part of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, gulfcoastlive.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Rachel Iacovone and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thank you for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.